Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants of this show are not the views. Opinions expressed by the participants of this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
I'm Zach Burchi. Justin's here.
Hey, everyone.
And joining us this week, very special guest. Very excited to have him on, especially with the Academy Awards coming up right around the corner. Our guest is from G-Kids. He's the director of distribution there. It's Dave Justette. Dave, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So we're really excited to have you on. First of all, congratulations on the two Academy Award nominations. That's a huge deal.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
And I guess for maybe our listeners who don't know or aren't familiar with G-Kids, can you give us sort of the basic rundown of what G-Kids is and what they do?
Sure. So we're an independent film distributor located in New York City. We were actually born out of the New York International Children's Film Festival, which started about 15 years ago. G-Kids itself is about 7 years old. We had the original mandate of releasing family films, but we quickly pivoted to doing exclusively animation. So we're, as far as I know, the only distributor focused entirely on animated features. And that includes films both for families as well as pretty much exclusively for adults, titles like Chico and Rita from Fernando Treba or the Alzheimer's drama Wrinkles. So we really try to explore kind of a broad spectrum of what animated storytelling can be. And that includes... naturally, films from animated, you know, animation sort of stalwart countries like France, UK, as well as, of course, Japan, with a number of anime titles that we've handled as well.
Right. And specifically, what do you do there?
Sure. So it's a broad question. We're basically akin to a startup, so we're a small company. So I do a lot of things. Everything from, I mean, I guess the primary thing people probably know is just booking the films into theaters. So if a film played, you know, at a theater near you, or you constantly complain about, you know, the fact that our films don't go wide enough and they're not playing at a theater near you, that's either my doing or my fault, as well as with my colleague in the theatrical department. We also handle home video. So even though we work with distributors like Cinedigm or Universal for our home video releases, we handle a lot of that kind of stuff in-house in terms of prepping the releases and making sure that the artwork looks good and the bonus features are there. And so I handle a lot of that as well. You know, general marketing, cutting trailers, helping design posters, a little bit of everything. It's a pretty broad assignment.
Wow. Okay. So how long have you been with the company?
So I'm employee number one, or I guess employee number two, depending on how you count my business partner.
Oh, really?
Yep. So I've been there for, we're 7 years old, and I've been there since day one, basically.
And specifically, when did you guys start looking at anime? Was that, like, really early on? Because, I mean, the choice is a little obvious for what you do, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, going back to sort of the roots in terms of... the New York Children's Film Festival, they had done a very early, I mean, early relative to just how fast sort of that category has broken out, like 1999, seems very recent to me, but is in fact, you know, some of the first times that people actually started talking in, about anime in the mainstream. They did an anime retrospective there and have premiered several Studio Ghibli films. So a lot of our contacts and relationships in terms of being very friendly with Studio Ghibli and knowing... Production IG and some of the other, you know, big production companies really comes out of that festival experience. And in terms of distribution, you know, I guess title number two or three, one of our first distributed titles while we were still sort of getting our sea legs, you know, we handled a French film from Michel Ocelot called Azher and Asmar. We helped Nina Paley with her free release to the public of Sea to Sings the Blues. And I think title number three was helping Funimation with the release of Mamoru Hosoda's Summer Wars. So, you know, anime played a pretty key role early on in terms of just as we started to distribute films and pick up that skill set.
Right, right. And so there was sort of a watershed moment, or at least that's how I would describe it. You can stop me if I'm wrong. When you became the theatrical distributor for 13 or so titles from the Ghibli back catalog.
Oh, yeah. That was a lot of fun.
And I feel like that material, getting you know, being the theatrical distributor for that material, and you know, and then now releasing some of the stuff Disney doesn't do, doesn't release on home video, has really put you guys in sort of a position of prominence with anime fans who are, you know, insatiably curious about what you guys do, what your outfit is like. Can you tell us a little bit about how that deal went down? Like, what was involved with that, and how did it work out for you?
Sure. So, I mean, Studio Ghibli is definitely one of the, I guess, key kind of feathers in our caps, and it's one of the amazing sort of things for myself, you know, just growing up with a worn-out Fox VHS of Totoro.
Right.
It's one of the kind of early films, you know, and my business partner being very much the same way. You know, we were very attuned to Ghibli and, you know, had a really deep and abiding respect for, you know, all the directors there, Miyazaki and Takahata. And the employees there who just are pretty amazing. so, you know, as I mentioned, sort of we knew them through the Children's Festival probably about 10 years ago or something like that. And so it's not like they were, you know, they sort of knew who we were. And then as we started distributing films, there came kind of a fateful conversation where they had mentioned, you know, that basically no one was exploiting the rights to the films in theaters. And I don't know how much people sort of know about this. Is a kind of a complex rights situation, but basically due to really high exhibition standards, Studio Ghibli has exhibition standards sort of akin to what I've heard of Stanley Kubrick, basically, where a lot of people, you know, if you're playing a film in a public library or a museum or something like that, they're just popping on a DVD and playing it, and someone's getting, you know, public performance rights for that, but basically they're covering their own. You know, it's just a disc. And Ghibli doesn't actually allow that. Ghibli, in order to screen a film in public from the Ghibli library of titles, you have to either have a 35mm film or, with the transition to digital, a what's called a DCP, which is a digital cinema package, and those are the hard drives of high-definition content that are delivered to theaters now. Not even a Blu-ray will suffice. So they got in sort of this weird situation where, you know, they would only allow films to be played on film, and yet no film prints existed, basically, of the English language version. All the titles that Disney had were on home video only, on DVD only. And so they sort of asked us as distributors, you know, did we think there was something there where we created basically the film prints, you know, we could book the films, we could bring them back to theaters, which is something that they really love. They want films to be seen in a theatrical setting. So, of course, that was a no-brainer for us. I mean, that's just an amazing opportunity. And I think, you know, it's hard to imagine how it could have gone any better in terms of debut events in New York and Los Angeles. And I think really gratifying seeing, I guess, what's kind of considered, at least in, New York urban parlance, as like sort of the smaller markets like a Nashville or something like that, seeing even in places that I think a lot of L.A. and New York-based distributors sort of assume to be smaller cities, to see overwhelming sellout crowds, great press response, people sort of discovering titles like only yesterday for the first time, discovering that there's more than one director, that's not just Miyazaki, for the first time. You know, that's all just kind of a really incredible experience. And so building off of that, having handled those titles, you know, in such a fashion, I think that really opened up a lot of discussions in terms of now that as they continue to make new films, wanting to, you know, basically handle not just the theatrical and the non-theatrical, but home video and basically all rights, just like a Disney or another company would.
So are you negotiating directly with Ghibli?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you don't have to go through Disney?
No.
And the rights, and so you're sort of distributing the stuff that Disney doesn't do.
Well, I mean, by the fact that we distribute it, I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding generally in the community that like we get sort of Disney's leftovers.
That is the misunderstanding. Yeah. So if you could clear that up, yeah, that would be fantastic.
No, we go head to head with Disney on every title. And if we are distributing a title, it's because we won. It's not because, you know, Disney didn't want it or passed on it. I mean, I think it, you know, that's, these negotiations are all kind of really complex and, you know, I have, first of all, you know, a real deep respect for Disney, and I've actually worked with a lot of those guys. We work with them very closely on the retrospective because for a lot of titles, you know, they have in their libraries somewhere dusty prints from the 90s of some of these films, and we've had to, you know, track down things like that. And so, you know, I don't want to necessarily, you know, disparage them or anything, but, you know, I think a lot of these negotiations are much more about what the vision is for the film, you know, what theaters can you reach, kind of what is the overall marketing message, how are you going to advance? In the case of The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, really wanting to highlight you know, Isao Takahata basically as a director in his own right, and a lot of these things, these conversations hinge on more points than just, you know, what money is at stake, because obviously just being a multi-billion dollar corporation, Disney could spend us into the ground, you know, in a moment if they wanted to, but often a lot of these conversations with filmmakers and things hinge on much more than just the sheer financial bottom line. It's a lot about kind of what the vision for the film is.
So that's interesting. So I think the conception is that Disney has sort of right of first refusal on everything, and that you just take whatever they don't. But you're saying that it's a bidding thing. You guys put together a pitch, and Disney has to make a pitch as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, to be honest, there's always situations, and this is true not just of Ghibli, but with all, you know, just the film world in general is a relationship-driven business. So there are filmmakers we're definitely closer to where I would be sort of surprised if, you know, all things being equal, they didn't take, you know, our offer over a competitor just because we've worked together for years. In the same way, I know, you know, Miyazaki has a very close and personal relationship with John Lasseter, who, of course, exerts a lot of, you know, creative influence inside of the Disney Pixar realm. And so, you know, I know that relationship is also extremely important to them and continues on to this day to be very strong. And, you know, he's an amazing guy and really just a have a great force in his own right in the world of animation. I think some of the stuff they're doing is really is pretty great. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's really just, you know, it's about kind of, I guess, what the best fit for the film is. And sometimes, you know, I think that there are titles that, that Disney might still be interested in and titles that we're certainly interested in. And in those kind of situations, it's just an old fashioned, you know, put your best, offer out there and describe sort of what you would do and just talk it through basically.
Right. And I think as a result, like, I think you can kind of look at the differences in the titles that the two of you, yourself and Disney, wind up with. That you guys wind up with the stuff that's maybe a little bit more adult, maybe a little less immediately commercial, if you would even agree with that characterization.
Yeah, I think it's no surprise. I mean, when you look at the zeros attached to various box office, you know, I think that, I think we do a strong job releasing the films that we have. And I think that there's no argument that, you know, a film like Secret World of Arrietty, which I think is the highest grossing Ghibli film still, something like 15 million or something like that. It's a very different kind of film, just in terms of pacing, in terms of the fantasy elements and all of that, than, you know, a title like Come Up on Poppy Hill, say, or Princess Kaguya. Even though that has more of a fantasy base, it's also almost 2.5 hours. It's exceedingly beautiful, but contemplative and things like that. So, you know, I think they are sort of built to the different company's strengths. I think that's probably a fair, you know, fair assumption.
Right. Okay. Moving into like the home video stuff. Tell us a little bit about that process. Like, how do you determine, okay, we're going to work with a partner to release this on home video?
Sure. So we work with partners on all of our films. We don't have a home video sales team. And that's something that, as a a spry sort of, I guess, I don't know if we can still call ourselves a startup because we're a little older now, but we still sort of very much think that way. And so one of the things that we really don't want to do is have to tie down a sales staff that's there just to help make some of these, you know, things like making sure Amazon has their orders and things like that. So we always partner with an ancillary partner like Cinedigm in the past, or Universal, starting with our current two titles, who helps us basically. We oversee a lot of the creative direction and the actual, you know, what bonus features arrive, making sure that the master is perfect and all of that. But in terms of literally with a Deluxe or Technicolor, shipping it out, getting like the wholesale operation going, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's a lot of back-end function and marketing as well, where we team up together. So that's really, and that's not necessarily, we don't have a permanent output deal. It's something that we sort of, when we first look at taking on a title, we'll talk to the people we've worked with in the past and sort of figure out who the best fit on the ancillary end would be, just like, you know, when we talk with filmmakers, they're trying to get a fit for who, you know, the best sort of distribution as a whole is coming from. And a lot of times we'll be able to say, okay, we have, I think, you know, we have a strong chance to, you know, maybe get this into, I guess it's called like a mass title, which is like conveying something that has a likelihood of arriving at Walmart or Target. And that's sort of like, I guess, the gold standard for, you know, what people care about when they want to ship 100,000 DVDs. Or, you know, I think this is probably more of a specialty title, which means, you know, it'll probably be in a couple of stores and primarily online. We'd still love to handle it, but just, you know, want to keep, you know, keep all those models sort of in mind in terms of deciding whether it's the right fit for the company and for the film before we move forward.
Right. Okay. And so really there's not like a one approach to a title. It's not like, okay, this one we think is going to get, you know, into Target or whatever, and so we're going to release it with this partner this way. It sounds like every film is entirely its own little universe with different, you know, factors, and you have to take everything into consideration, decide on a partner, and then, you know, make all the decisions from there.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's not true. I mean, I'd be lying if we didn't have an inkling we were going in, like, you know, say a Studio Ghibli title, just given the sales record. They have a very solid track record that you can point to for every title, and just the fact that there's a dedicated base there. I mean, some of these titles, obviously, when you go into them, you just say, okay, this is likely to be one of my big titles, and, you know, we want to make sure that everything is aligned around it appropriately. But one thing that's really kind of important to me, and I know to the rest of the company as well, is we never want to be in the position where if we love a film, you know, I want to make those numbers work. And I don't want to be in the situation where I say, oh, I can't, you know, because I don't think that you're a commercial enough title because you're not, you know, suited for 4,000 retail locations or something like that. But therefore, I can't even, you know, help you. I want to be able to still work with small films that we love as well and say, okay, if we can all just agree that this will be the plan of attack, then I think, you know, we can definitely make something with this film that, you know, maybe another distributor might not, and still, you know, work hard and put out the best Blu-ray or DVD possible, put out the best theatrical release possible, but just kind of from day one sort of build everything sort of around kind of what scale we think the title is going to move towards.
Okay. All right. So we got to talk about the Oscars. So this is super exciting. And I am insanely curious to know what goes into, like, what does G-Kids do to get those nominations? What's the process like? How much shoe leather do you have to spend, you know? Because it's all political, right? So tell us what that's like lobbying to get these things nominated.
Yeah, so I mean, definitely the Oscars, I think, are one of the most kind of exciting things that we're involved in. This year would be our fifth and sixth nominations in as many years. So now we're six years. I think that's makes us one of the top independents, certainly in the animation category, and I think ranks up there with some of the studios. And for us, you know, it really just comes down to the film. I mean, we do have sort of a strategy that we followed since the very first year, which was Tom Moore's The Secret of Kells, and we actually kind of stumbled into that purely by accident. A previous distributor had acquired the film, gone out of business, and the title was sort of back on the market, and we'd worked with the sales agent on a different title. She said, oh, I have this film. I think it's perfect for you. We'd actually played it before, so we knew of it. So like, I really want you to handle it. The only catch is they really want an Oscar, you know, submission, and the deadline's in like 3 or 4 days. So we filled out all the paperwork extremely fast, got all the signatures, and just sort of, I guess, walked our way through the first campaign, meeting people along the way that we still work with to this day. Just kind of an amazing group of PR people and kind of this nascent group of, I guess, what you would call campaign strategists, but are really people who are from the animation community, who care deeply about animation, know people who care deeply about animation, are able to talk about the films intelligently. And basically from that point on, it's all just about the strength of the film. You know, I think that a lot of people, when they think of Oscar campaigns, they think of the billboards and the Variety ads and all the different kind of for your consideration advertising you see everywhere, especially this time of year or in like November or December. The animated category is a little bit different. It's actually voted on by the animation branch as well as some other members who opt in, and they have to watch almost all the films, either in screening or on DVD now, and they just vote. I mean, they vote, they fill out, you know, 1 through 10 rankings. And I think when people see all those ads, they think, oh, there's no way that a small company can compete on that level, which is true with people who are spending millions of dollars. But if you think about it in terms of just wanting to make sure that the voters are taking the film seriously and that when they go in the room, in a dark room, you know, watch the film and vote, that you have one of the best films, then I think, you know, the odds get much better, and we've been able to capitalize on that. I think, you know, people's perceptions when they step in and watch a G-Kids film, you know, we always want to be in the position where we're representing a great film. I don't want to, you know, have people come out and say, like, I can't believe, you know, they wasted their time or wasted our time with that. And yeah, so from there, it's really just about making sure that the voters have a chance to see the film. They know that, you know, it's competing. We'll take out some advertisements, but certainly not anything akin to what, you know, our competitors do, all of which are films that have grossed $200 or $300 million. So, you know, spending a couple of million on an awards campaign is, you know, a fraction of a budget, I guess, in terms of what their overall advertising spends must look like. But yeah, it's something that I think has been really great. And for me, it actually speaks a lot to, I think, what people's original perception of the Academy Awards is supposed to be all about. I mean, I think there's become an increasing sort of feeling like, oh, you know, they're only, you know, what do the awards sort of represent? And to me, it's about sort of preserving for the record, the official record, basically, of this may not have been, you know, literally the best film. We list a couple of films, you know, there's nominees, basically. And if you look back, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, you know, you get kind of a good sense for where the industry was at that moment. And being able to kind of capture these independent, smaller animated productions and put them next to, you know, How to Train Your Dragon 2 or Big Hero 6, I think is both really validating for the directors and the creators to be sort of acknowledged by their Hollywood peers as craftsmen and as sort of superb directors, and also really helps, I think, cement the film's legacy as something that I hope people continue to check out in the years ahead, even if, you know, they didn't catch it in theaters or even buy it on DVD the first year, just for future generations to be able to know that, you know, there were these independent films as well as the big studios. I think that's really an important service that the Academy offers.
How big a difference does it make when one of your films gets nominated? Is there a substantial, I imagine there's a substantial noticeable uptick in sales and home video sales as a result?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can't, it's hard to put an official price tag on it, but there's no doubt that it's a huge benefit. I mean, I know Song of the Sea, our current film, which is actually from the director of The Secret of Kells, so he's 2 for 2, and it's really great to be sort of back in that experience with him. But, you know, that film just opened in theaters December 19th, and we were holding off of most of the expansion in theaters until the end of January because we had a feeling going into the campaigning that we had something special and we wanted to be able to capitalize on that. So seeing that come true, you know, we added basically 100 theaters in a day. You know, I'll probably see the box office, you know, triple or quadruple over what we had sort of expected before the awards. And certainly for home video, I think it really helps, you know, both in terms of DVDs shipped, increasingly where your real money is, which is, you know, on your iTunes, your digital transactional kind of platforms, Netflix or Amazon Prime, those sort of things. So it does have a huge legacy, not just actually for us. One of the interesting things is the Oscars are one of the few sort of awards that move the needle globally. So a lot of partners on these films actually waited to sort of see, because I guess we've acquired some sort of mystique over the years, to see what would happen with the titles that we were running with this year, Princess Kaguya and Song of the Sea, and then plan their releases accordingly. So now you're seeing a little bit later releases in the UK and other territories that are really built around wanting to draft off that local interest. It's a great kind of endorsement, I guess, for the quality of the film, even for international audiences as well.
So now that you have the nomination and the word is out there, and I imagine the box office uptick for Kaguya has been pretty great, or both films, as a matter of fact, I'm sure you'd love to win, but have you already reaped the reward, so to speak, or do you think there's more potentially if Kaguya takes it home?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we're always in the position where we're happy to be nominated. Everyone's happy to be nominated. And we see a lot of, at our scale, a lot of benefits just from the nomination. Absolutely, I would love to win. And this year, actually, we are, campaigning on behalf of both films. I think it's really interesting, that with the Lego Movie not getting nominated, sort of the film everyone thought was going to walk away with the category is now an open race. And, so a lot of people are kind of focusing on How to Train Your Dragon 2 versus, Big Hero 6. But for us, that sounds like maybe a split vote. So, there's
one can hope
up the middle. So, so I think that's definitely something that the filmmakers are acutely aware of and we're aware of. And, around this time, you normally get kind of a sense for where the race is at. I know last year we had this beautiful French film, which is an amazing film called Ernest and Celestine, which was up against Frozen. And, you sort of, at first we were like, I wasn't quite sure, was this really registering with critics? Was it really, what would Academy voters think? And it really just like kept staying and staying in theaters and just kept becoming like a monster until you sort of just knew it was a foregone conclusion. So, that night we showed up to party and to drink, basically. nominated with Secret of Kells was up against Up. And, Up was one of like probably Pixar's most beloved and critically acclaimed films. That was also sort of a foregone conclusion. This year doesn't feel like a foregone conclusion at all. And I think we are actively campaigning to the best of our ability, basically knowing that nothing will sort of erase that financial gap. But ultimately, you are still talking about films that people need to watch. And it's about getting the DVDs in voters' hands, getting the films, getting people to attend screenings, and just getting people, if they love the film, to talk about the film and share the film and say, hey, have you checked this out yet? Knowing that, a lot of voters talk to other voters, and there's a lot of other ways to wage a campaign besides just buying, full page, full site interstitial ads on like every website that you visit.
But you still had to send out a few thousand screeners.
We did, yeah, and we opted to do that early. That's something that we actually haven't done in some of the past years. And sort of as we've become more, I would say, attuned to campaigning and things like that, we've become aware, basically, that you have to send out the screeners in what's called phase one, which is the early part. It's a little bit strange because for us, we're sending out screeners to all voters, even though only a fraction of them are actually voting on the nomination process. And it's really just sort of a bet of confidence that if we are lucky enough to be nominated, we want to make sure that their screeners are in people's hands and they say, oh, this film, I have it, I'm going to watch it, rather than starting the process, which does take several weeks, on nomination morning, trying to say, okay, how fast can we jam out those screeners and get them out to people? Knowing that once they arrive, do they even have time to watch them in a couple of days before voting, all that kind of stuff. In order to have sort of a shot even at a win, I think you have to have people have to have the opportunity to see the film before, it's elementary, really, before voting starts.
Right. And just to clarify an earlier statement, it's just the animation people that nominate, but the whole Academy votes once their nomination's on the final winner, correct?
The whole Academy votes on the final. There's several different branches. So when you join the Academy, you join in a branch. You have the executives and the directors and actors and things like that. So people who vote on animated features are not just animators, but they are drawn from the animation branch as well as additional people from across disciplines who have said to the Academy, I would like to be part of this group, sort of similar to how, I guess, foreign language is handled, where people say, this is a category that's of interest to me. I would like to be part of the process of nominating. So you end up definitely a lot of animators, but you do get actors and directors and things like that as well, who are sort of across disciplines voting in the nomination part of it.
And I have to ask, because, Takahata Sensei is a lot known to be a lot less, say, grumpy cat than Miyazaki. Will he be attending?
Yeah, definitely. He was at the nominee luncheon yesterday. You can see him in the photos.
Oh, hey. How did I miss
that? I think, you know, one of the great things about sort of having Princess Kaguya be nominated, and, you know, it was definitely a huge thrill, but, you know, to have that late career recognition for Isao Takahata was, I think, really important to us and one of the things that we were really campaigning hard for. You know, he's been fairly upfront. A lot of people have said Kaguya is his last film. He's repeatedly said he would happily make another film if someone just gave him the money and time to do it. But, you know, realistically, he's also said that that's not likely, and this may well be his last film. So to be able to finally be able to say, you know, from the Academy Award nominated director, and not just like from acclaimed director, I think there's sort of an education that goes on, even among, frankly, sort of Ghibli fans who maybe aren't really hardcore about it. I think people, even people who say, oh yeah, I love Ghibli, I love, you know, Totoro, I love Castle in the Sky, I love Kiki, you know, they list a lot of Miyazaki titles. And I think that's just because, you know, Takahata hasn't made a film since 1999. So it was a long gap sort of at the same time that Ghibli was becoming famous, you know, worldwide. You know, he wasn't really adding new films into the fray because he was working on a variety of projects and also Princess Kaguya. So to finally have that validation, I think, is really nice. And I think that he appreciates that. I think that that does mean something to him.
Awesome. Now, there is one Takahata movie that specifically a Ghibli era Takahata movie that you cannot get in the United States on home video. Only yesterday, one of my personal favorites. Is there a chance that, you know, with all this new attention Takahata's getting, that we might be able to see that?
I can't believe it took half an hour to get to Only Yesterday.
That's, I know.
Kind of record.
What's wrong with me?
That would be question one. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's as always a complicated situation around that title. I think a lot of people's, what I've seen, working assumptions around it have not been entirely correct. I would say that you'll eventually get a chance to see it, yeah. And I think one of the great things about having the film back in theaters was just the fact that anyone could see it. We have a subtitled film print that's been touring, you know, theaters for the last 3 or 4 years. And yeah, I imagine that someday, based on, you know, Princess Kaguya and based on just it being a nice film, someone will eventually handle that film.
All right. So, Justin, at some point in the future.
Thank God I bought the Japanese.
Waited. Well, I mean, you, whatever. You waited, like, what, 15 years?
Oh, for Only Yesterday? Oh, weeks, you know? Yeah. well, I have the Japanese Blu-ray. If you guys or Disney or somebody brings it out, I'll buy it again.
It sounds fair enough. It sounds like you get that question a whole lot.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely something that is I'm acutely aware of, thanks to Twitter and everything. I think most of our interactions revolve around that. Just because I've also, we've been tied to it, you know, theatrically. We do have the film print, we have the theatrical, non-theatrical rights. And it is, you know, a really great film. So, you know,
right.
Who knows?
So I wanted to mention this before we get to the Twitter questions and the question from the fans. It's interesting that, I know G-Kids is sort of inexorably tied to the New York Children's International Film Festival. And years ago, I saw the debut of the English dub of Porco Rosso at the New York International Children's Film Festival premiere.
Oh, yeah, I was there too, actually.
Yeah, and I was just curious. So were you there for that?
Probably not. No, I don't think so. I think I was in a different city. My business partner, Eric Beckman, actually founded the festival 15 years ago. I think that was, what, 2003? Something like that?
Right, yeah, it was long, it was 2004, I think.
Yeah, so but I haven't actually come to New York yet.
So my question is a demographic one, actually, because I living there in New York and being in this line of work, we went to a lot of Children's International Film Festival screenings of Ghibli movies. And I noticed, and, you know, I'm sure this is maybe just the Manhattan demographic, but, it, you know, the kids in attendance were all Park Avenue kids. Like, and for a while there, and I think they still kind of do, Ghibli films had a reputation as being, like, you put them on the shelf next to, like, the Young Einstein stuff, you know, things that sort of wealthy parents get their kids because it's supposed to enrich them or something. I was wondering if you would ever noticed something similar to that demographically, like when people get Ghibli films for their kids, is that more of a, is that like a, the demographically, is that more like a higher end thing? Like it's sort of perceived as this like high end, sophisticated children's entertainment.
I don't know. I mean, I'll say, I don't know what motivations are driving, you know, parents to purchase things for their kids, but I will say that I think Studio Ghibli, sort of uniquely, I think, has managed to escape, I guess what I would call the anime ghetto in terms of a lot of people who say, oh, you know, they don't self-identify as anime fans or don't even really recognize that as a category or anything like that. We'll say, oh, yeah, I love, you know, Spirit Away or whatever. So for, I think, a lot of people, a Studio Ghibli film might be the only anime film that they own just because of, I guess, whether it's the... cultural, you know, imprimatur they've got because of the awards and because everyone's told them that, you know, Miyazaki is a genius and you know, all of that. Or just because they're, frankly, some of the most accessible titles. I mean, they've been some of the only anime titles really to hit theaters on a regular basis. Yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely, when we release a film from Ghibli and, you know, we can count on sort of, I guess I would call the educated parents block, you know, turning out in theaters and hopefully buying the disc. I would also say that's generally true of a lot of our films. I mean, that's kind of one of our audiences, which of course we always hope to broaden whenever possible. But, you know, sort of, I guess the parents who are interested enough in new experiences, both for themselves and for their kids, that they'll check out something that didn't receive a whole lot of TV commercials, but just looks like, you know, a great film, has some good review quotes or something like that, you know, that's part of our audience. And I think Ghibli definitely fits, you know, perfectly in that block.
Right. Interesting.
Oh, one last question. You mentioned earlier the importance of video on demand platforms like iTunes. I noticed that I don't think anybody has online rights to any Ghibli movies. Is that the case?
Yes, that's by design. Studio Ghibli films aren't carried on iTunes or any digital platforms, with the exception of the, which is not really even a film, it's not like a feature film from them, but the documentary Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, which we released with them late last year, is available on iTunes and Amazon and some of those other digital outlets, you know, as a documentary. But in terms of like their feature films, no, they're not available on iTunes or other digital platforms.
Yeah,
seems kind of old-fashioned.
Ghibli old-fashioned. That's
going to change someday. I mean, I assume just the way the industry is going.
Are they allowing? I imagine they're allowing you to put out DCPs of their old films, at least.
Yeah, I mean, we get them from. They very carefully restore the films, and I think I believe Totoro is actually a 4K DCP. So they do some really great restoration work on their older films, often in preparation, you know, for home video release or something like that. But yeah, we get the DCPs from Studio Ghibli's lab and they look fantastic. So it's not like they're averse to digital in any way in terms of you know, some of those future formats in terms of exhibition in theaters. It's just for whatever reason, the digital side of like download to own or like the iTunes kind of thing has so far not happened for their catalog.
You can forget about Netflix, is that right?
Oh, yeah, for SVOD. Yeah, I think that for streaming stuff, yeah, I think, no, nothing is available as far as I know.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thanks for making that documentary available because
yeah,
it's an incredible piece.
I think it's a great movie. I hope people check it out. It's one of those things that, you know, I'm sorry I didn't get to more theaters. It was sort of our first experiment with what's called a day and date release where it hits a few theaters at once and then iTunes and stuff like that. But for anyone who's at all interested in Studio Ghibli or just really in filmmaking in general, I think it helps to be a Ghibli fan, but Miyazaki is such like a philosopher, just like a character basically, that just hanging out with him for 2 hours is really kind of an amazing experience.
Well, I mean, and Justin and I are sort of on the same page on this, that we sort of felt like that documentary was integral to understanding The Wind Rises. Like, it's really important that you see that film if you're at all confused by the intent of that movie. Like, it's really important piece of filmmaking. So, yeah, thanks. Okay, so let's get to these questions from fans. Actually, out of curiosity, how often do you deal with, like, anime fans, like, as a group?
I mean, I still, I'm on Twitter daily.
Yeah,
that's not, there's now another, as we've grown in stature, it used to be just myself basically on Twitter for years, but we now have other people who also monitor the account. So if you see people saying things, it's not necessarily me, but someone definitely does read all that stuff. And whatever, I used to troll forums, and we staffed a booth at the New York Comic Con this past year. So, you know, it's one of those things that I like dealing with the audience, basically. I mean, for me, it's talking with people who have actually seen the films or are interested in the films is, you know, a gratifying experience. It's kind of hard, I think, when you talk about it in purely economical terms. That's one of the least interesting ways that I think the film industry gets dealt with. It's just like, oh, you know, the movie made X amount of money. It's either good or not good. You know, to talk to people who maybe, whatever, 1,000 people saw the film and not 10 million, but 1,000 people are like rabid fans who, you know, dress up in cosplay costumes and stuff for it. And I think that's just like, that's really cool. I know the directors often are really gratified by that kind of, you know, people actually liking their films and dealing with their films as films and not just like a 2-hour babysitter or something like that you put on and walk away and the kids are watching it.
Yeah, that's cool. Is it, I mean, so you're like, why aren't there any From Up on Poppy Hill cosplayers here?
Seems like a pretty simple costume. I don't know.
Yeah, right. But you gotta carry, you gotta carry that bike around. Maybe it's a hassle. Okay, so questions from the fans. Trick the TM, and we got, there's a few questions that are sort of down this line. He asks, was your release of Welcome to the Space Show an indication that you're interested in going after older, unreleased films, not just new stuff?
I think so. I mean, that film wasn't originally as old when we first started working with it. It's just one of those films that this happens from time to time where the rights will go through various people. People who you're negotiating with to take over a film, like, come and leave their jobs. So, like, you know, it's sort of like a sales lead runs hot and cold, sometimes for years. So we didn't intend for that film to be like 5 or 6 years old when we released it. But generally, I think that there is an entire category of, you know, for a certain kind of film, if it's good and it doesn't really matter when it was made. And, you know, I think it does have sometimes an impact on what kind of theatrical release we can give it. But certainly for home video, we're all we're doing is trying to present the best possible version. Yeah, I think that's definitely something that we're interested in. We've actually added a number of catalog, I guess what we call catalog titles, to our hit list in terms of when we talk about acquisitions, trying to play the game a little bit more in terms of figuring out what rights have lapsed and what materials, you know, what HD releases exist overseas that haven't been released here, that sort of stuff that I think people kind of expect from someone who's releasing more, you know, older titles as well as just stuff that's brand new.
Daniel Jayberg asks, has your company name, G-Kids, impacted people's perspectives on animation or your film library just being for children?
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. Someday we may change our name, I don't know. I always sort of wait for the day when it becomes like a Kid Robot style thing where it's like it's sort of divorced from any kind of the word physical word kids and what that evokes for people. I think, you know, just the breadth of the titles that we release and the fact that we just keep releasing them, I hope that eventually just starts solidifying in people's minds the variety and you know, the kind of different stories that you can talk about without literally just being like, oh, this is not appropriate for my 5-year-old. But some of my favorite emails are from people who have emailed me angry comments having purchased, like, Chico and Rita, which has nudity, drugs, sex, jazz, all that stuff, just being like, I thought this was for kids, and just like, it's not appropriate at all. Yeah. Knowing that the cover is basically just like two people, like, whatever, essentially leaning over each other. And just like, I don't understand. Like, if literally all you're looking at is the name of the company and you're ignoring the rest of the content, that seems pretty narrow minded to me.
Yeah, but it's a little silly. Yeah, that's sort of on them.
That doesn't, but, have, yeah, doesn't that have an R rating?
Right.
I'm sorry, doesn't that movie have an R rating?
It's actually unrated. So what we ended up doing is we did a thing on the back. What we always do for films, basically, because not all films do get rated, films that we think will play wide in theaters or be carried by like a Walmart or something. People who tend to really kind of try to monitor those things. You know, in those cases, those films get rated. But otherwise, if a film is basically a PG-13 or an R, we add a content box that's very large and very visible on the back saying, like, this film is, you know, intended for adult audiences. It features, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or in the case of The Rabbi's Cat, which is a really fun film, but more, I think, a borderline PG-13 sort of story. And you may not necessarily know that from the cover art. Trying to just describe, you know, recommended, basically trying to describe it in a way that makes it clear it's equivalent to a PG-13 sort of like for, you know, teens basically end up or something like that. So we do, you know, I don't mean to be totally glib about it. We do actually take the content side pretty seriously because I do want people to make the right decision. But at the end of the day, you know, if you ignore the content warning and, you know, you ignore all the images and descriptive words and the synopsis and everything that leads you to believe, oh, this film is nothing, you know, Wrinkles, which is about friendship sort of blossoming in an old folks' home. You know, if there are certain keywords there that don't clue you in, then at some point we have to just let it go. So, you know, we grapple with that all the time.
All right. A New Type Century asks if there will ever be a Blu-ray release for The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness.
Not from us. I know it was a bummer, but Blu-ray releases are really expensive. And so, you know, for us, when we, just in terms of the encoding, in terms of, you know, a lot of those production elements. So it's really a shame. And I do wish that, you know, we were able to do it. But when we looked at the anticipated sales of something like that, I think that there is a passionate fan base that would care very deeply. And I'm sorry, you know, we couldn't deliver for them. But knowing that that fan base was one of the only people who may have bought that, you know, in a Blu-ray format as opposed to, you know, the more standard DVD, which still ships predominantly. For us, it's like a 75-25 often. 75% DVD, 25% Blu-ray or something like that. So on an already kind of niche title, you know, you really have to watch those numbers and try to make the right decision. So it is available, I think, in HD on digital download, so through iTunes and Amazon, remarkably, unlike other Ghibli features. But in terms of the home format, from us, it'll stay DVD. I know they did a Blu-ray in Japan. I'm not sure what other territories have planned for it.
Maddie125 wants to know if you've shown any interest or have any interest in the Ghibli shorts.
Oh, everyone's interested in them. The question is, who's going to pry them away from the Ghibli Museum's hands? Those are extremely, you know, they take those very seriously, and they're really, it's sort of wed to the company's DNA, is that you really get to experience those shorts, or you should only experience those shorts at the Ghibli Museum, sort of on a random basis, the way that they've been shown for years. So, you know, when I visited Ghibli last summer, which was amazing, I got to go to the museum and see one, and it was just like, I wish I could have just sat and seen like all dozen of them immediately, but something about sort of just how difficult it was to physically see just that one made it, I think, something a little bit more special than just a short film. For the time being, I don't think anyone will be able to release them in any format except at the museum.
Okay. All right. Kirben asks, what is the status of Zarafa? It's a French animated movie that you licensed in 2012.
Yep. Yep. It's, you know, for that, we're working on the dub right now. We do dub a lot of our films ourselves using some really great friends who I think are probably familiar to the anime community, Michael Center Nicholas and Stephanie Shea. And Zarafa was just at the back of the queue behind a couple of titles that we had to finish. And now it's getting its very own dub right this minute. So it's supposed to come out in theaters this summer, and I think it's going to be worth the wait.
All right. WTK asks, you handled theatrical distribution for Giovanni's Island. Since the movie's already dubbed in English, are you thinking about a DVD or Blu-ray release in North America?
So we're certainly aware of Giovanni. I mean, we're very friendly with Production IG. We don't have any rights to it, and nothing has been sort of announced this time. But I would just say that, you know, I like the film. We like the film a lot. And I know the UK guys who released it did a great job with it. So We don't have anything planned with it at the moment, but I'm sure someone will release it in short order in North America.
I have a question, actually, to follow up on the last one. Whatever happened to a DVD and Blu-ray release of Mia and the Magoo? I really like that movie. Nice little kids movie that literally ends in the third impact.
Yeah. No, that's a great movie. It was one of our very first. It was our first dub, actually, that we handled. And so in a lot of ways, it taught us pretty much all the lessons that we could possibly learn about how that whole process works. And it was released on DVD a number of years ago, actually, by Entertainment One, which is actually one of the only releases we've done with E1. So the DVD does exist, and you can purchase it online, or I'm not sure if it's still carried in broad retail stores yet, but some sleuthing, you know, should be able to find it. And that was a DVD-only release as well. That wasn't a Blu-ray. They wanted to, or you know, we combined on the effort, wanted to do kind of a special kind of eco-friendly packaging and try to offer a lower price point and hopefully get it open to more families. I'm ultimately not sure how successful that was, but that was always kind of the goal, was to try to make it as attractive and accessible for families as possible, because I think it's a really beautiful film, and I think it's also kind of got a, to the extent that messages in film matter anymore, it's got a nice message. So.
And finally, he also asks, are you interested at all in working with television series? Like, Studio Ghibli has a television series out, and at all curious about working with properties like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the really short answer is no. You know, I'm always reluctant to, you know, get into feature creep, basically, where we always have to fight ourselves whenever we go to festivals and we see a live action film that we really love, and just knowing that there's a bunch of other companies who are equipped very well to do that. I mean, one of the questions I think we always have to ask ourselves for any film, particularly for anime as well, I mean, we don't actually release all that much anime. And so when we release it, it's sort of for us a question of, you know, what can we do in terms of bringing a new audience, in terms of, you know, whether it's an awards campaign or something that, you know, our friends at, you know, Funimation or whoever might not necessarily have the same idea. And so for TV series is, you know, if someone else is going to release it and it's not going to just sit there on the shelf, then, you know, it would have to be pretty convincing for me. You know, that said, there are older properties that maybe, you know, out of print or things like that that are important historically in the history of animation. I could eventually see possibly doing that, but more as part of kind of our mission just to release great animation than anything, and to play kind of a historical role and bringing some of that back to the surface. But in terms of like who's going to compete for kind of modern, you know, what's hot in terms of new animated series, is whether from Japan or elsewhere. That's not particularly a game I think we're well suited for, and one that I don't think we'll be involved in.
All right. Well, that actually wraps us up. I can't thank you enough for coming by and answering some questions with us today. I really appreciated you giving us a little bit of your time. So thank you very much, and best of luck to you at the Academy Awards.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to David for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a rating and review. We'd really appreciate it. We'll see you all next week.